He had joined them because the North Vietnamese spoke French. They all just came to Moscow without any assurances that the Russians would permit them to talk with the Vietnamese, or that, if they did, any information would be forthcoming. None of them spoke Russian. They asked if I knew anyone who could help them. My old friend Nikki Alexis was studying English, French, and Russian at Patrice Lumumba University. I introduced her to them, and they spent a couple of days together making the rounds, checking in with the American embassy, asking the Russians to help, finally seeing the North Vietnamese, who apparently were impressed that Mr. Fors and his friends would make such an effort to learn the fate of his son and several others who were missing in action. They said they would check into it and get back to them. A few weeks later, Henry Fors learned that his son had been killed when his plane was shot down. At least he had some peace of mind. I thought of Henry Fors when I worked to resolve the POW-MIA cases as president and to help the Vietnamese find out what had happened to more than 300,000 of their people still unaccounted for. On January 6th, Nikki and her Haitian friend Helene put me on the train to Prague, one of the most beautiful old cities in Europe, still reeling from the Soviet repression of Alexander Dubček's Prague Spring Reform Movement in August 1968. I had been invited to stay with the parents of Jan Koppeld, who played basketball with me at Oxford. The Koppelds were nice people whose personal history was closely entwined with that of modern Czechoslovakia. Mrs. Koppeld's father had been editor-in-chief of the communist newspaper Rude Pravo, died fighting the Nazis in World War II, and had a bridge in Prague named for him. Both Mr. and Mrs. Koppeld were academics and had been big supporters of Dubček. Mrs. Koppeld's mother also lived with them. She took me around town during the day when the Koppelds were working. They lived in a nice apartment in a modern high-rise with a beautiful view of the city. I stayed in Jan's room and was so excited I woke up three or four times a night just to stare at the skyline. The Koppelds, like all Czechs I met, held on to the belief that their chance at freedom would come again. They deserved it as much as anyone on earth. They were intelligent, proud, and determined. The young Czechs I met were especially pro-American. They supported our government in Vietnam because we were for freedom and the Soviets weren't. Mr. Koppeld once said to me, "Even the Russians cannot defy forever the laws of historical development." Sure enough, they couldn't. In 20 years, Václav Havel's peaceful Velvet Revolution would reclaim the promise of Prague Spring. 10 months after I left the Koppelds to go back to Oxford, I received the following notice from them, written on simple white paper with black borders. "With immense pain, we want to inform his friends that on July 29th, in the University Hospital in Smyrna, Turkey, died at the young age of 23, Jan Koppeld. For a long time, it was his great desire to visit what remains of the Hellenic culture. It was not far from Troy that he fell from a height and succumbed from the injuries he sustained. I really like Jan, with his ready smile and good mind. When I knew him, he was tortured by the conflict between his love of Czechoslovakia and his love of freedom. I wish he had lived to enjoy both." After 6 days in Prague, I stopped in Munich to celebrate Faschingsfest with Rudy Lowe, then returned to England with renewed faith in America and democracy. For all its faults, I had discovered that my country was still a beacon of light to people chafing under communism. Ironically, when I ran for president in 1992, the Republicans tried to use the trip against me, claiming that I had consorted with communists in Moscow. With a new term, I got back into my tutorials in politics, including studies on the relevance of scientific theories to strategic planning. The problem of making a conscript army into a patriotic one, from Napoleon to Vietnam, and the problems China and Russia posed for U.S. policy. I read Herman Kahn on the probabilities of nuclear war, different destruction levels, and post-attack behavior. It was strangelove-like and unconvincing. I noted in my diary that what happens after the fireworks begin may not pursue the set course of any scientific systems and analysis models. While I was enduring another sunless English winter, letters and cards from home streamed in. My friends were getting jobs, getting married, getting on with their lives. Their normalcy looked pretty good after all the anguish I'd felt over Vietnam. March and the coming of spring brightened things up a bit. I read Hemingway, tended to tutorials, and talked to my friends, including a fascinating new one. Mandy Merck had come to Oxford from Reed College in Oregon. She was hyperkinetic and highly intelligent, the only American woman I met at Oxford who was more than a match for her British counterparts in fast, free-flowing conversation. She was also the first openly lesbian woman I'd known. March was a big month for my awareness of homosexuality. Paul Parrish came out to me, too, and was mortally afraid of being branded a social pariah. He suffered for a long time. Now he's in San Francisco and, in his own words, safe and legal. Mandy Merck stayed in England and became a journalist and gay rights advocate. Back then, her brilliant banter brightened my spring. Rick Stearns threw me for a loop one night when he told me I was unsuited for politics. He said Huey Long and I both had great Southern political styles, but Long was a political genius who understood how to get and use power. He said my gifts were more literary and that I should be a writer because I wrote better than I spoke, and besides, I wasn't tough enough for politics. A lot of people have thought that over the years. Rick was close to right, though. I never loved power for power's sake, but whenever I got hit by my opponents, I usually mustered enough toughness to survive. Besides, I didn't think I could do anything else as well. In early 1970, having received Jeff Dwyer's tape recounting his conversation with Colonel Holmes and the high lottery number, I knew I was out of ROTC and wouldn't be drafted at least until late in the year. If I wasn't called, I was torn between coming back to Oxford for a third year, which the Rhodes Scholarship would cover, or going to Yale Law School if I was accepted. I loved Oxford maybe too much. I was afraid if I came back for a third year, I might drift into a comfortable but aimless academic life that would disappoint me in the end. Given my feelings about the war, I wasn't at all sure I'd ever make it in politics, but I was inclined to go back home to America and give it a chance. In April, during the break between second and third terms, I took one last trip to Spain with Rick Stearns. I had been reading up on Spain and was totally mesmerized by it, thanks to André Malraux's Man's Hope, George Orwell's Homage to Catalonia, and Hugh Thomas's masterly The Spanish Civil War. Malraux explored the dilemma war presents to intellectuals, many of whom were drawn to fight against Franco. He said the intellectual wants to make distinctions, to know precisely what he is fighting for and how he must fight, an attitude that is by definition anti-Manichaean, but every warrior is by definition a Manichaean. To kill and stay alive, he must see things starkly as black and white, evil and good. I recognized the same thing in politics years later when the far right took over the Republican Party and the Congress. Politics to them was simply war by other means. They needed an enemy, and I was the demon on the other side of the Manichaean divide. I never got over the romantic pull of Spain. The raw pulse of the land, the expansive, rugged spirit of the people, the haunting memories of the lost Civil War, the Prado, the beauty of the Alhambra. When I was president, Hillary and I became friends with King Juan Carlos and Queen Sofia. On my last trip to Spain, President Juan Carlos had remembered my telling him of my nostalgia about Granada and took Hillary and me back there. After 30 years, I walked through the Alhambra again, in a Spain now democratic and free of Francoism, thanks in no small part to him. At the end of April, when I got back to Oxford, Mother called to tell me that David Leopoulos's mother, Evelyn, had been murdered, stabbed 4 times in the heart in her antique store. The crime was never solved. I was reading Thomas Hobbes's Leviathan at the time, and I remember thinking he might be right that life is poor, nasty, brutish, and short. David came to see me a few weeks later on his way back to army duty in Italy, and I tried to lift his spirits. His loss finally provoked me to finish a short story on Daddy's last year and a half and his death. It got pretty good reviews from my friends, provoking me to write in my diary, "Perhaps I can write instead of being a doorman when my political career is in shambles." I had fantasized from time to time about being a doorman at New York's Plaza Hotel at the south end of Central Park. Plaza doormen had nice uniforms and met interesting people from all over the world. I imagined garnering large tips from guests who thought that, despite my strange southern accent, I made good conversation. In late May, I was accepted at Yale and decided to go. I finished up my tutorials on the concept of opposition, the British Prime Minister, and political theory, preferring Locke to Hobbes. On June 5th, I gave one last speech to an American military high school graduation. I sat on a stage with generals and colonels, and in my speech told why I loved America, respected the military, and opposed the Vietnam War. The kids liked it, and I think the officers respected the way I said it. On June 26th, I took the plane to New York after emotional goodbyes, especially with Frank Aller, Paul Parrish, and David Edwards, this time for real. Just like that, it was over. 2 of the most extraordinary years of my life. They began on the eve of Richard Nixon's election and ended as the Beatles announced they were breaking up and released their last movie to loving, mourning fans. I had traveled a lot and loved it. I had also ventured into the far reaches of my mind and heart, struggling with my draft situation, my ambivalence about my ambition, and my inability to have anything other than brief relationships with women. I had no degree, but I had learned a lot. My long and winding road was leading me home, and I hoped that, as the Beatles sang in Hey Jude, I could at least take a sad song and make it better. Chapter 17. In July, I went to work in Washington for Project Purse Strings, a citizens' lobby for the McGovern-Hatfield Amendment, which called for a cutoff of funding for the Vietnam War by the end of 1971. We had no chance to pass it, but the campaign to do so provided a vehicle to mobilize and highlight growing bipartisan opposition to the war. I got a room for the summer at the home of Dick and Helen Dudman, who lived in a great old 2-story house with a big front porch in Northwest Washington. Dick was a distinguished journalist. He and Helen both opposed the war and supported the young people who were trying to stop it. They were wonderful to me. One morning they invited me down to breakfast on the front porch with their friend and neighbor, Senator Gene McCarthy. He was serving his last year in the Senate, having announced back in 1968 that he wouldn't run again. That morning he was in an open, expansive mood, offering a precise analysis of current events and expressing some nostalgia at leaving the Senate. I liked McCarthy more than I expected to, especially after he loaned me a pair of shoes to wear to the black tie women's press dinner, which I think the Dudmans got me invited to. President Nixon came and shook a lot of hands, though not mine. I was seated at a table with Clark Clifford, who had come to Washington from Missouri with President Truman and had served as a close advisor and then as defense secretary to President Johnson in his last year in office. On Vietnam, Clifford noted dryly, "It's really one of the most awful places in the world to be involved." The dinner was a heady experience for me, especially since I kept my feet on the ground in Gene McCarthy's shoes. Shortly after I started at Purse Strings, I took a long weekend off and drove to Springfield, Massachusetts for the wedding of my Georgetown roommate, Marine Lieutenant Kit Ashby. On the way back to Washington, I stopped in Cape Cod to visit Tommy Kaplan and Jim Moore, who had also been at Kit's wedding. At night, we went to see Carolyn Yeldell, who was singing on the Cape with a group of young entertainers for the summer. We had a great time, but I stayed too long. When I got back on the road, I was dead tired. Before I even made it out of Massachusetts on the interstate highway, a car pulled out of a rest stop right in front of me. The driver didn't see me, and I didn't see him until it was too late. I swerved to miss him, but I hit the left rear of his car hard. The man and woman in the other car seemed to be dazed but unhurt. I wasn't hurt either, but the little Volkswagen Bug Jeff Dwyer had given me to drive for the summer was badly mangled. When the police came, I had a big problem. I had misplaced my driver's license on the move home from England and couldn't prove I was a valid driver. There were no computerized records of such things back then, so I couldn't be validated until the morning. The officer said he'd have to put me in jail. By the time we got there, it was about 5 a.m. They stripped me of my belongings and took my belt so that I couldn't strangle myself, gave me a cup of coffee, and put me in a cell with a hard metal bed, a blanket, a smelly stopped-up toilet, and a light that stayed on. After a couple of hours of semi-sleep, I called Tommy Kaplan for help. He and Jim Moore went to court with me and posted my bond. The judge was friendly but reprimanded me for not having my license. It worked. After my night in jail, I was never without my license again. 2 weeks after my trip to Massachusetts, I was back in New England to spend a week in Connecticut working for Joe Duffy in the Democratic primary election for the U.S. Senate. Duffy was running as the peace candidate, aided primarily by the people who had made a good showing for Gene McCarthy 2 years earlier. The incumbent senator, Democrat Tom Dodd, was a longtime fixture in Connecticut politics. He had prosecuted Nazis at the Nuremberg War Crimes Tribunal and had a good progressive record, but he had two problems. First, he had been censured by the Senate for the personal use of funds that had been raised for him in his official capacity. Second, he had supported President Johnson on Vietnam, and Democratic primary voters were much more likely to be anti-war. Dodd was hurt and angered by the Senate censure and not ready to give up his seat without a fight. Rather than face a hostile electorate in the Democratic primary, he filed as an independent to run in the November general election. Joe Duffy was an ethics professor at Hartford Seminary Foundation and president of the Liberal Americans for Democratic Action. Though he was a coal miner's son from West Virginia, his strongest supporters were prosperous, well-educated, anti-war liberals who lived in the suburbs and young people drawn to his record on civil rights and peace. His campaign co-chairman was Paul Newman, who worked hard in the campaign. His finance committee included the photographer Margaret Bork White, artist Alexander Calder, New York cartoonist Dana Fraden, and an extraordinary array of writers and historians, including Francine Duplessis Gray, John Hersey, Arthur Miller, Vance Packard, William Shire, William Styron, Barbara Tuchman, and Thornton Wilder. Their names looked pretty impressive on the campaign stationery, but they weren't likely to impress many voters among blue-collar ethnics. Between July 29th and August 5th, I was asked to organize two towns in the 5th Congressional District, Bethel and Trumbull. Both were full of old white wooden houses with big front porches and long histories that were chronicled in the local registers. In Bethel, we put in phones the first day and organized a telephone canvass to be followed by personal deliveries of literature to all the undecided voters. The office was kept open long hours by dedicated volunteers, and I was pretty sure Duffy would get his maximum possible vote there. Trumbull didn't have a fully operational headquarters. The volunteers were phoning some voters and seeing others. I urged them to keep an office open from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday, and to follow the Bethel canvassing procedure, which would guarantee two contacts with all persuadable voters. I also reviewed the operations in two other towns that were less well organized and urged the state headquarters to at least make sure they had complete voter lists and the capacity to do the phone canvass. I liked the work and met a lot of people who would be important in my life, including John Podesta, who served superbly in the White House as staff secretary, deputy chief of staff, and chief of staff, and Susan Thomases, who, when I was in New York, let me sleep on the couch in the Park Avenue apartment where she still lives, and who became one of Hillary's and my closest friends and advisors. When Joe Duffy won the primary, I was asked to coordinate the 3rd congressional district for the general election. The biggest city in the district was New Haven, where I'd be going to law school, and the district included Milford, where I would be living. Doing the job meant that I'd miss a lot of classes until the election was over in early November, but I thought I could make it with borrowed notes and hard study at the end of term. I loved New Haven with its cauldron of old-fashioned ethnic politics and student activists. East Haven, next door, was overwhelmingly Italian, while nearby Orange was mostly Irish. The towns farther away from New Haven tended to be wealthier, with the ethnic lines more blurred. The two towns at the eastern end of the district, Guilford and Madison, were especially old and beautiful. I spent a lot of time driving to the other towns in the district, making sure our people had a good campaign plan in place and the support and materials they needed from the central headquarters. Since my Volkswagen had been ruined in the wreck in Massachusetts, I was driving a rust-colored Opel station wagon, which was better suited to delivering campaign materials anyway. I put a lot of miles on that old station wagon. When my campaign work permitted, I attended classes in constitutional law, contracts, procedure, and torts. The most interesting class by far was constitutional law, taught by Robert Bork, who was later put on the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, and in 1987 was nominated for the Supreme Court by President Reagan. Bork was extremely conservative in his legal philosophy, aggressive in pushing his point of view, but fair to students who disagreed. In my one memorable exchange with him, I pointed out that his argument on the question at issue was circular. He replied, "Of course it is. All the best arguments are." After the primary election, I did my best to bring the supporters of the other candidates into the Duffy campaign, but it was tough. I'd go into the heavily ethnic blue-collar areas and make my best pitch, but I could tell I was hitting a lot of stone walls. Too many white ethnic Democrats thought Joe Duffy, whom Vice President Agnew had called a Marxist revisionist, was too radical, too identified with dope-smoking anti-war hippies. Many of the ethnic Democrats were turning against the war, too, but they still didn't feel comfortable in the company of those who had been against it before they were. The campaign to win them over was complicated by the fact that Senator Dodd was running as an independent, so the disgruntled Democrats had someplace else to go. Joe Duffy ran a fine campaign, pouring his heart and mind into it and inspiring young people all across the country, but he was defeated by the Republican candidate, Congressman Lowell Weicker, a maverick who later left the Republican Party and served as governor of Connecticut as an independent. Weicker got just under 42% of the vote, enough to beat Duffy handily. Duffy got less than 34%, with Senator Dodd garnering almost 25%. We got killed in ethnic towns like East Haven and West Haven. I don't know if Duffy would have won if Dodd hadn't run, but I was sure the Democratic Party was headed for minority status unless we could get back the kind of folks who voted for Dodd. After the election, I talked about it for hours with Ann Wexler, who had done a superb job as campaign manager. She was a great politician and related well to all kinds of people, but in 1970, most voters weren't buying the message or the messengers. Ann became a great friend and advisor to me over the years. After she and Joe Duffy got married, I stayed in touch with them. When I was in the White House, I appointed him to run the United States Information Agency, which oversaw the Voice of America, where he took America's message to a world more receptive to him than the Connecticut electorate had been in 1970. I thought of it as Joe's last campaign, and he won it. The brightest spot in November 1970 was the election of a young Democratic governor, Dayole Bumpers, in Arkansas. He handily defeated former Governor Faubus in the primary and won the general election over Governor Rockefeller in a landslide. Bumpers was an ex-Marine and a great trial lawyer. He was funny as all get out and could talk an owl out of a tree. And he was a genuine progressive who had led his small hometown of Charleston in conservative western Arkansas to peacefully integrate its schools, in stark contrast to the turmoil in Little Rock. 2 years later, he was reelected by a large margin, and 2 years after that, he became one of our U.S. senators. Bumpers proved that the power of leadership to lift and unite people in a common cause could overcome the South's old politics of division. That's what I wanted to do. I didn't mind backing candidates who were almost certain to lose when we were fighting for civil rights or against the war. But sooner or later, you have to win if you want to change things. I went to Yale Law School to learn more about policy. And in case my political aspirations didn't work out, I wanted a profession from which I could never be forced to retire. After the election, I settled into law school life, cramming for exams, getting to know some of the other students, and enjoying my house and my three roommates. Doug Eakley, my fellow Rhodes Scholar at UNIV, found a great old house on Long Island Sound in Milford. It had four bedrooms, a good-sized kitchen, and a large screened-in porch that opened right onto the beach. The beach was perfect for cookouts, and when the tide was out, we had enough room for touch football games. The only drawback to the place was that it was a summer house with no insulation against the whipping winter winds. But we were young and got used to it. I still vividly remember spending one cold winter day after the election, sitting on the porch with a blanket wrapped around me, reading William Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury. My other housemates at 889 East Broadway were Don Pogue and Bill Coleman. Don was more left-wing than the rest of us, but he looked more blue-collar. He was built like a concrete block and as strong as an ox. He drove a motorcycle to law school, where he engaged all comers in endless political debate. Luckily for us, he was also a good cook and was usually on good behavior, thanks to his equally intense but more nuanced English girlfriend, Susan Bucknell. Bill was one of the growing number of black students at Yale. His father was a liberal Republican lawyer, they still existed back then, who had clerked for Justice Felix Frankfurter on the Supreme Court and had served as Secretary of Transportation under President Ford. On the surface, Bill was the most laid-back of our group. Besides my roommates, I knew only a few other students when I got back to Yale after the Duffy campaign, including my Boys Nation friend from Louisiana, Fred Kammer, and Bob Reich. Because he was secretary of our Rhodes class, Bob kept up with everyone and was a continuing source of information and humorous misinformation on what our old crowd was up to. Bob was living in a house near campus with three other students, one of whom, Nancy Bekovac, became a special friend of mine. She was a passionate liberal whose anti-war convictions had been confirmed the previous summer when she worked in Vietnam as a journalist. She wrote beautiful poems, powerful letters, and great class notes, which she let me use when I showed up for class 2 months late. Through Bill Coleman, I got to meet a number of black students. I was interested in how they came to Yale and what they planned to do with what, back then, was still an unusual opportunity for African Americans. Besides Bill, I became friends with Eric Clay from Detroit, whom I later appointed to the U.S. Court of Appeals. Nancy Gist, a Wellesley classmate of Hillary's, who served in the Justice Department when I was president, Lila Colburn, who gave up law to become a psychotherapist, Rufus Cormier, a big, quiet man who starred at guard on the Southern Methodist University football team, and Lonnie Guinier, whom I tried to appoint Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, a sad story the details of which I'll relate later. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas was a classmate too, but I never got to know him. Near the end of the term, we heard that Frank Aller had decided to return to America. He moved back to the Boston area and went home to Spokane to face the draft music. He was arrested, arraigned, then released pending trial. Frank had decided that whatever impact he had had by resisting had been achieved, and he didn't want to spend the rest of his life out of America, looking forward to a cold, bitter middle age in some Canadian or British university, forever defined by Vietnam. One night in December, Bob Reich said it seemed foolish for Frank to risk jail when there was so much he could do out of the country. My diary notes my reply. A man is more than the sum of all the things he can do. Frank's decision was about who he was, not what he could do. I thought it was the right one. Not long after he got back, Frank had a psychiatric exam in which the doctor found him depressed and unfit for military service. He took his draft physical and, like Strobe, was declared 1Y, draftable only in a national emergency. On Christmas Day, I was back home in Hot Springs, a long way from Helsinki Bay, where I'd walked on the ice the previous Christmas. Instead, I walked the grounds of my old elementary school, counted my blessings, and marked the changes in my life. Several of my close friends were getting married. I wished them well and wondered whether I would ever do so. I was thinking a lot about the past and my roots. On New Year's Day, I finished C. Van Woodward's The Burden of Southern History, in which he noted Southerners' peculiar historical consciousness, what Eudora Welty called the sense of place. Arkansas was my place. Unlike Thomas Wolfe, whose cascading prose I so admired, I knew I could go home again. Indeed, I had to. But first, I had to finish law school. I got to spend my second term at Yale as a proper law student with the heaviest class load of my stay there. My business law professor was John Baker, Yale Law's first black faculty member. He was very good to me, gave me some research work to supplement my meager income, and invited me to his house for dinner. John and his wife had gone to Fisk University, a black school in Nashville, Tennessee, in the early 60s, when the civil rights movement was in full flower. He told me fascinating stories about the fear they lived with and the joy he and his classmates found in the work of the movement. I took constitutional law with Charles Reich, who was as liberal as Bob Bork was conservative, and the author of one of the seminal countercultural books about the 1960s, The Greening of America. My criminal law professor, Steve Duke, was a witty, acerbic man and a fine teacher with whom I later did a seminar on white-collar crime. I really enjoyed political and civil rights taught by Tom Emerson, a dapper little man who had been in FDR's administration and whose textbook we used. I also took Professor William Leon McBride's National Law and Philosophy, did some legal services work, and got a part-time job. For a few months, I drove to Hartford four times a week to help Dick Sussman, a Democratic businessman I'd met in the Duffy campaign, with his work on the city council. Dick knew I needed the work, and I think I was some help to him. In late February, I flew to California for a few days to be with Frank Aller, Strobe Talbot, and Strobe's girlfriend, Brooke Shearer. We met in Los Angeles at the home of Brooke's extraordinarily welcoming and generous parents, Marva and Lloyd Shearer, who for many years wrote America's most widely read celebrity gossip column, Walter Scott's Personality Parade. Then in March, I went up to Boston where Frank was living and looking for work as a journalist, to see him and Strobe again. We walked in the woods behind Frank's house and along the New Hampshire coast nearby. Frank seemed glad to be home, but still sad. Even though he had escaped the draft and prison, he seemed caught in the throes of a depression, like that which Turgenev said, only the very young know and which has no apparent reason. I thought he'd get over it. The spring lifted my spirits as it always did. The political news was a mixed bag. The Supreme Court unanimously upheld busing to achieve racial balance. The Chinese accepted an American invitation to reciprocate the visit of the American ping pong team to China by sending their team to the United States. And the war protests continued. Senator McGovern came to New Haven on May 16th, plainly with the intention of running for president in 1972. I liked him and thought he had a chance to win because of his heroic record as a bomber pilot in World War II, his leadership of the Food for Peace program in the Kennedy administration, and the new rules for delegate selection for the next Democratic convention. McGovern was heading a commission to write them for the purpose of ensuring a more diverse convention in terms of age, race, and gender. The new rules, plus the weight of anti-war liberals in the primaries, virtually assured that the old political bosses would have less influence and the party activists more in the 1972 nominating process. Rick Stearns had been working for the commission, and I was sure he'd be tough and smart enough to devise a system favorable to McGovern. While law school and politics were going well, my personal life was a mess. I had broken up with a young woman who went home to marry her old boyfriend, then had a painful parting with a law student I liked very much but couldn't commit to. I was just about reconciled to being alone and was determined not to get involved with anyone for a while. Then one day, when I was sitting at the back of Professor Emerson's class in political and civil rights, I spotted a woman I hadn't seen before. Apparently, she attended even less frequently than I did. She had thick, dark, blonde hair and wore eyeglasses and no makeup, but she conveyed a sense of strength and self-possession I had rarely seen in anyone, man or woman. After class, I followed her out, intending to introduce myself. When I got a couple of feet from her, I reached out my hand to touch her shoulder, then immediately pulled it back. It was almost a physical reaction. Somehow I knew that this wasn't another tap on the shoulder, that I might be starting something I couldn't stop. I saw the girl several times around school over the next few days, but didn't approach her. Then one night, I was standing at one end of the long, narrow Yale Law Library talking to another student, Jeff Gleckel, about joining the Yale Law Journal. Jeff urged me to do it, saying it would assure me a good clerkship with a federal judge or a job with one of the blue-chip law firms. He made a good case, but I just wasn't interested. I was going home to Arkansas, and in the meantime preferred politics to the law review. After a while, I suddenly stopped paying attention to his earnest entreaty, because I saw the girl again, standing at the other end of the room. For once, she was staring back at me. After a while, she closed her book, walked the length of the library, looked me in the eye, and said, "If you're going to keep staring at me and I'm going to keep staring back, we ought to at least know each other's names. Mine's Hillary Rodham. What's yours?" Hillary, of course, remembers all this, but in slightly different words. I was impressed and so stunned I couldn't say anything for a few seconds. Finally, I blurted my name out. We exchanged a few words, and she left. I don't know what poor Jeff Gleckel thought was going on, but he never talked to me about the law review again. A couple of days later, I was coming down the steps to the ground floor of the law school when I saw Hillary again. She was wearing a bright flowered skirt that nearly touched the floor. I was determined to spend some time with her. She said she was going to register for next term's classes, so I said I'd go too. We stood in line and talked. I thought I was doing pretty well until we got to the front of the line. The registrar looked up at me and said, "Bill, what are you doing back here? You registered this morning." I turned beet red, and Hillary laughed that big laugh of hers. My cover was blown, so I asked her to take a walk with me to the Yale Art Gallery to see the Mark Rothko exhibit. I was so eager and nervous that I forgot the university workforce was on strike and the museum was closed. Luckily, there was a guard on duty. I pleaded my case and offered to clean up the branches and other litter in the museum's garden if he'd let me in. The guard took a look at us, figured it out, and let us in. We had the whole exhibit to ourselves. It was wonderful, and I've liked Rothko ever since. When we were done, we went out to the garden, and I picked up the sticks. I suppose I was being a scab for the first and only time in my life, but the union didn't have a picket line outside the museum, and besides, politics was the last thing on my mind. After I paid my cleaning-up dues, Hillary and I stayed in the garden for another hour or so. There was a large, beautiful Henry Moore sculpture of a seated woman. Hillary sat in the woman's lap, and I sat beside her talking. Before long, I leaned over and put my head on her shoulder. It was our first date. We spent the next several days together just hanging around, talking about everything under the sun. The next weekend, Hillary went up to Vermont on a long-planned visit to the man she had been dating. I was anxious about it. I didn't want to lose her. When she got home late Sunday night, I called her. She was sick as a dog, so I brought her some chicken soup and orange juice. From then on, we were inseparable. She spent a lot of time at our house on the beach and quickly won over Doug, Don, and Bill. She didn't do so well with my mother when she came to visit a few weeks later, partly because she tried to cut her own hair just before Mother arrived. It was a minor fiasco. She looked more like a punk rocker than someone who had just walked out of Jeff Dwyer's beauty salon. With no makeup, a work shirt and jeans, and bare feet coated with tar from walking on the beach at Milford, she might as well have been a space alien. The fact that I was obviously serious about her gave Mother heartburn. In her book, Mother called Hillary a growth experience. It was a girl with no makeup, Coke bottle glasses, and brown hair with no apparent style, versus a woman with hot pink lipstick, painted on eyebrows, and a silver stripe in her hair. I got a kick out of watching them try to figure each other out. Over time, they did, as Mother came to care less about Hillary's appearance, and Hillary came to care more about it. Underneath their different styles, they were both smart, tough, resilient, passionate women. When they got together, I didn't stand a chance. By mid-May, I wanted to be with Hillary all the time. As a result, I met several of her friends, including Susan Graber, a Wellesley classmate of hers, whom I later appointed to a federal judgeship in Oregon. Carolyn Ellis, a bright, funny Lebanese woman from Mississippi who could out-Southern me and is now Chancellor of the University of Mississippi. And Neil Steinman, the brightest man I met at Yale, who raised the first funds for me in Pennsylvania in 1992. I learned about Hillary's childhood in Park Ridge, Illinois, her 4 years at Wellesley, where she switched her politics from Republican to Democrat because of civil rights and the war, her post-graduation trip to Alaska, where she slimed fish for a living, and her interest in legal services for poor people and in children's issues. I also heard about her famous commencement speech at Wellesley, in which she articulated our generation's contradictory feelings of alienation from the political system and determination to make America better. The speech got a lot of national publicity and was her first brush with fame beyond the boundaries of her immediate environment. What I liked about her politics was that, like me, she was both idealistic and practical. She wanted to change things, and she knew that doing so required persistent effort. She was as tired as I was of our side getting beat and treating defeat as evidence of moral virtue and superiority. Hillary was a formidable presence in law school, a big fish in our small but highly competitive pond. I was more of a floating presence, drifting in and out. A lot of the students we both knew talked about Hillary as if they were a little intimidated by her. Not me. I just wanted to be with her. But time was running out on us. Hillary had accepted a summer job at Truhaft, Walker & Bernstein, a law firm in Oakland, California, and I had been asked to take a job as coordinator of the Southern States for Senator McGovern. Until I met Hillary, I was really looking forward to it. I was going to be based in Miami, and the job required traveling throughout the South, putting state campaigns together. I knew I'd be good at it, and though I didn't think McGovern could do very well in the general election in the South, I believed he could win a fair number of convention delegates during the primary season. Regardless, I'd have the political experience of a lifetime. It was a rare opportunity for a 25-year-old. One I got from a combination of my friendship with Rick Stearns, who had an important post in the campaign, and affirmative action. They had to have at least one Southerner in a responsible position. The problem was, I no longer wanted to do it. I knew if I went to Florida, Hillary and I might be lost to each other. Though I found the prospect of the campaign exciting, I feared, as I wrote in my diary, that it would simply be a way of formalizing my aloneness, letting me deal with people in a good cause but at arm's length. With Hillary, there was no arm's length. She was in my face from the start, and before I knew it, in my heart. I screwed up my courage and asked Hillary if I could spend the summer with her in California. She was incredulous at first, because she knew how much I loved politics and how deeply I felt about the war. I told her I'd have the rest of my life for my work and my ambition, but I loved her and wanted to see if it could work out for us. She took a deep breath and agreed to let me take her to California. We had been together only about a month. We stopped briefly in Park Ridge to meet her family. Her mother, Dorothy, was a lovely, attractive woman, whom I got along with from the start. But I was as alien to Hillary's father as Hillary was to mother. Hugh Rodham was a gruff, tough-talking Republican who, to say the least, was suspicious of me. But the more we talked, the more I liked him. I resolved to keep at it until he came around. Soon we drove on to Berkeley, California, near her job in Oakland, where she would be staying in a small house owned by her mother's half-sister, Adeline. After a day or two, I drove back across the country to Washington to tell Rick Stearns and Gary Hart, Senator McGovern's campaign manager, that I couldn't go to Florida after all. Gary thought I had lost my mind to pass up such an opportunity. I suppose Rick did, too. To them, I suppose I did look like a fool. But your life is shaped by the opportunities you turn down as well as by those you seize. I did feel bad about leaving the campaign, and I offered to go to Connecticut for a couple of weeks to set up an organization there. As soon as I had signed up people in every congressional district, I headed back to California, this time by the southern route so I could stop at home. I enjoyed the drive west, including a visit in the Grand Canyon. I got there in the late afternoon and crawled out on a rock jutting over the canyon's edge to watch the sun go down. It was amazing the way the rocks, compressed into distinct layers over millions of years, changed colors as the canyon darkened from the bottom up. After I left the canyon, I had a blistering drive across Death Valley, America's hottest spot, then turned north to my summer with Hillary. When I walked into her house in Berkeley, she greeted me with a peach pie, my favorite, that she had baked herself. It was good. And it didn't last long. During the day when she was at work, I walked all over the city, read books in the parks and coffee shops, and explored San Francisco. At night, we'd go to movies or local restaurants or just stay in and talk. On July 24th, we drove down to Stanford to hear Joan Baez sing in the open amphitheater. So that all her fans could see her, she charged only $2.50 for admission. A striking contrast to the high-ticket prices of today's big concerts. Baez sang her old hits, and for one of the first times in public, the night they drove Old Dixie down. When the summer ended, Hillary and I were nowhere near finished with our conversation, so we decided to live together back in New Haven, a move that doubtless caused both our families concern.
End of Disc 8. Disc 9.
When the summer ended, Hillary and I were nowhere near finished with our conversation, so we decided to live together back in New Haven, a move that doubtless caused both our families concern. We found an apartment on the ground floor of an old house at 21 Edgewood Avenue near the law school. The front door of our apartment opened into a tiny living room, behind which was a smaller dining room area and an even smaller bedroom. Behind the bedroom were an old kitchen and a bathroom so small the toilet seat sometimes scraped against the bathtub. The house was so old that the floor sank from the walls to the middle at an angle so pronounced I had to put little wooden blocks under the inside legs of our small dining table. But the price was right for penurious law students, $75 a month. The nicest thing about the place was the fireplace in the living room. I still remember sitting in front of the fire on a cold winter day as Hillary and I read Vincent Cronin's biography of Napoleon together. We were too happy and too poor to be anything but proud of our new home. We enjoyed having friends over for meals. Among our favorite guests were Rufus and Yvonne Cormier. They were both children of African-American ministers in Beaumont, Texas, who grew up in the same neighborhood and had gone together for years before they married. While Rufus studied law, Yvonne was getting her Ph.D. in biochemistry. Eventually, she became a doctor, and he became the first black partner of the big Houston law firm Baker & Botts. One night at dinner, Rufus, who was one of the best students in our class, was bemoaning the long hours he spent studying. "You know," he said in his slow drawl, "life is organized backwards. You spend the best years studying, then working. When you retire at 65, you're too old to enjoy it. People should retire between the ages of 21 and 35, then work like hell till they die." Of course, it didn't work out that way. We're all closing in on 65 and still at it. I really got into my third semester of law school with courses in corporate finance, criminal procedure, taxation, estates, and a seminar in corporate social responsibility. The seminar was taught by Burke Marshall, a legendary figure for his work as Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights under Robert Kennedy, and Jan Deutsch, reputed to be the only person up to that time to make the honors grade in all his classes at Yale Law. Marshall was small and wiry with bright, dancing eyes. He barely spoke above a whisper, but there was steel in his voice and in his spine. Deutsch had an unusual clipped stream of consciousness speaking style, which moved rapidly from one unfinished sentence to another. This was apparently the result of a severe head injury incurred when he was hit by a car and flew a long distance in the air before coming down hard on concrete. He was unconscious for several weeks and woke up with a metal plate in his head. But he was brilliant. I figured out his speaking style and was able to translate him to classmates who couldn't unpack his words. Jan Deutsch was also the only man I'd ever met who ate all of an apple, including the core. He said all the good minerals were there. He was smarter than I was, so I tried it. Once in a while, I still do, with fond memories of Professor Deutsch. Marvin Chirilstein taught me both corporate finance and taxation. I was lousy in taxation. The tax code was riddled with too many artificial distinctions I couldn't care less about. They seemed to me to provide more opportunities for tax lawyers to reduce their clients' obligation to help pay America's way than to advance worthy social goals. Once, instead of paying attention to the class, I read Gabriel Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude. At the end of the hour, Professor Chirilstein asked me what was so much more interesting than his lecture. I held up the book and told him it was the greatest novel written in any language since William Faulkner died. I still think so. I redeemed myself in corporate finance when I aced the final exam. When Professor Cherylstein asked me how I could be so good at corporate finance and so bad at taxation, I told him it was because corporate finance was like politics. Within a given set of rules, it was a constant struggle for power, with all parties trying to avoid getting shafted, but eager to shaft. In addition to my classwork, I had two jobs. Even with a scholarship and two different student loans, I needed the money. I worked a few hours a week for Ben Moss, a local lawyer doing legal research and running errands. The research got old after a while, but the errands were interesting. One day, I had to deliver some papers to an address in an inner-city high-rise. As I was climbing the stairs to the third or fourth floor, I passed a man in the stairwell with a glazed look in his eyes and a hypodermic needle and syringe hanging from his arm. He had just shot himself full of heroin. I delivered the papers and got out of there as quickly as I could. My other job was less hazardous but more interesting. I taught criminal law to undergraduates in a law enforcement program at the University of New Haven. My position was funded under the Federal Law Enforcement Assistance Program, which had just started under Nixon. The classes were designed to produce more professional law officers who could make arrests, searches, and seizures in a constitutional manner. I often had to prepare my lectures late in the evening before the day I delivered them. To stay awake, I did a lot of my work at the Elm Street Diner, about a block away from our house. It was open all night, had great coffee and fruit pie, and was full of characters from New Haven's nightlife. Tony, a Greek immigrant whose uncle owned the place, ran the diner at night. He gave me endless free refills of coffee as I toiled away. The street outside the diner was the border dividing the territory of two groups of street-walking prostitutes. From time to time, the police took them away, but they were always quickly back at work. The streetwalkers often came into the diner to get coffee and warm up. When they found out I was in law school, several would plop down in my booth in search of free legal advice. I did my best, but none took the best advice. Get another job. One night, a tall black transvestite sat down across from me, and he said his social club wanted to raffle off a television to make money. He wanted to know if the raffle would run afoul of the law against gambling. I later learned what he was really worried about was that the television was stolen. It had been donated to the club by a friend who ran a fencing operation, buying stolen goods and reselling them at a discount. Anyway, I told him that other groups held raffles all the time, and it was highly unlikely that the club would be prosecuted. In return for my wise counsel, he gave me the only fee I ever received for legal advice in the Elm Street Diner, a raffle ticket. I didn't win the television, but I felt well paid just at having the ticket with the name of the social club on it in bold print, The Black Uniques. On September 14th, as Hillary and I were walking into the Bluebell Cafe, someone came up to me and said it was urgent that I call Strobe Talbot. He and Brooke were visiting his parents in Cleveland. My stomach was in knots as I fed change into the payphone outside the cafe. Brooke answered the phone and told me Frank Aller had killed himself. He had just been offered a job to work in the Saigon Bureau of the Los Angeles Times, had accepted it, and had gone home to Spokane, apparently in good spirits, to get his clothes together and prepare for the move to Vietnam. I think he wanted to see and write about the war he opposed. Perhaps he wanted to put himself in harm's way to prove he wasn't a coward. Just when things were working out on the surface of his life, whatever was going on inside compelled him to end it. His friends were stunned, but we probably shouldn't have been. 6 weeks earlier, I had noted in my diary that Frank was really in the dumps again, having to that point failed to find a newspaper job in Vietnam or China. I said he had fallen finally, physically and emotionally, to the strains, contractions, pains of the last few years which he has endured, mostly alone. Frank's close, rational friends assumed that getting his external life back on track would calm his inner turmoil. But as I learned on that awful day, depression crowds out rationality with a vengeance. It's a disease that, when far advanced, is beyond the reasoned reach of spouses, children, lovers, and friends. I don't think I ever really understood it until I read my friend Bill Styron's brave account of his own battle with depression and suicidal thoughts, Darkness Visible, A Memoir of Madness. When Frank killed himself, I felt both grief and anger, at him for doing it and at myself for not seeing it coming and pushing him to get professional help. I wish I had known then what I know now, though maybe it wouldn't have made any difference. After Frank's death, I lost my usual optimism and my interest in courses, politics, and people. I don't know what I would have done without Hillary. When we first got together, she had a brief bout with self-doubt, but she was always so strong in public, I don't think even her closest friends knew it. The fact that she opened herself to me only strengthened and validated my feelings for her. Now I needed her, and she came through, reminding me that what I was learning, doing, and thinking mattered. In the spring term, I was bored in all my classes but evidence, taught by Jeffrey Hazard. The rules for what is and isn't admissible in a fair trial, and the process of making an honest and reasoned argument on the facts available, were fascinating to me and left a lasting impression. I always tried to argue the evidence in politics as well as law. Evidence counted a lot in my major law school activity that term, the annual Barristers Union trial competition. On March 28th, Hillary and I competed in the semifinals, from which four students plus two alternates would be chosen to participate in a full-blown trial to be written by a third-year student. We did well, and both made the cut. For the next month, we prepared for the prize trial, State versus Porter. Porter was a policeman accused of beating a long-haired kid to death. On April 29th, Hillary and I prosecuted Mr. Porter with the help of our alternate, Bob Alsdorf. The defense lawyers were Mike Conway and Tony Rude, with Doug Eakley as their alternate. The judge was former Supreme Court Justice Abe Fortas. He took his role seriously and played it to the hilt, issuing ruling after ruling on both sides and objections, all the while evaluating the four of us to decide who would win the prize. If my performance in the semifinals was the best public speaking of my law school career, my effort in the prize trial was the worst. I had an off day and didn't deserve to win. Hillary, on the other hand, was very good. So was Mike Conway, who gave an effective emotional closing argument. Fortas gave Conway the prize. At the time, I thought Hillary didn't get it, in part, because the dour-faced Fortas disapproved of her highly unprosecutorial outfit. She wore a blue suede jacket, bright, and I mean bright, orange suede flared pants, and a blue, orange, and white blouse. Hillary became a fine trial lawyer, but she never wore those orange pants to court again. Apart from the prize trial, I poured my competitive instincts into the McGovern campaign. Early in the year, I cleaned out my bank account to open a headquarters near the campus. I had enough money, about $200, to pay a month's rent and put in a telephone. In 3 weeks, we had 800 volunteers and enough small contributions to reimburse me and keep the place open. The volunteers were important for the coming primary campaign, which I assumed we'd have to wage against the Democratic organization and its powerful boss, Arthur Barbieri. 4 years earlier, in 1968, the McCarthy forces had done well in the primary in New Haven, partly because the Democratic regulars had taken Vice President Humphrey's victory for granted. I had no illusions that Barbieri would make that mistake again, so I decided to try to persuade him to endorse McGovern. To say it was a long shot is a gross understatement. When I walked into his office and introduced myself, Barbieri was cordial but businesslike. He sat back in his chair with his hands folded across his chest, displaying two huge diamond rings, one big circular one with lots of stones, the other with his initials, A.B., completely filled with diamonds. He smiled and told me that 1972 would not be a replay of 1968, that he had already lined up his poll workers and a number of cars to take his people to the polls. He said he had dedicated $50,000 to the effort, a huge sum in those days for a town the size of New Haven. I replied that I didn't have much money, but I did have 800 volunteers who would knock on the doors of every house in his stronghold, telling all the Italian mothers that Arthur Barbieri wanted to keep sending their sons to fight and die in Vietnam. "You don't need that grief," I said. "Why do you care who wins the nomination? Endorse McGovern. He was a war hero in World War II. He can make peace, and you can keep control of New Haven." Barbieri listened and replied, "You know, kid, you ain't so dumb. I'll think about it. Come back and see me in 10 days. When I returned, Barbieri said, "I've been thinking about it. I think Senator McGovern is a good man, and we need to get out of Vietnam. I'm going to tell my guys what we're going to do, and I want you to be there to make the pitch." A few days later, I took Hillary with me to the extraordinary encounter with Barbieri's party leaders at a local Italian club, the Melibus, in the basement of an old building downtown. The decor was all red and black. It was very dark, very ethnic, very un-McGovern. When Barbieri told his guys that they were going to support McGovern so that no more boys from New Haven would die in Vietnam, there were groans and gasps. "Arthur, he's almost a commie," one man blurted out. Another said, "Arthur, he sounds like a fag," referring to the senator's High Plains nasal twang. Barbieri never flinched. He introduced me, told them about my 800 volunteers, and let me give my pitch, which was heavy on McGovern's war record and work in the Kennedy administration. By the time the evening was over, they came around. I was ecstatic. In the entire primary process, Arthur Barbieri and Matty Troy of Queens in New York City were the only old-line Democratic bosses to endorse McGovern. Not all our troops were pleased. After the endorsement was announced, I got an angry late-night call from two of our stalwarts in Trumbull with whom I'd worked in the Duffy campaign. They couldn't believe I'd sold out the spirit of the campaign with such a nefarious compromise. "I'm sorry," I shouted into the phone. "I thought our objective was to win." And I hung up. Barbieri proved to be loyal and effective. At the Democratic convention, Senator McGovern got 5 of our congressional district 6 votes on the first ballot. In the November vote, New Haven was the only Connecticut city that went for him. Barbieri was as good as his word. When I became president, I tracked him down. He was in ill health and had long since retired from politics. I invited him to the White House, and we had a good visit in the Oval Office not long before he died. Barbieri was what James Carville calls a sticker. In politics, there's nothing better. Apparently, my work in Connecticut redeemed me in the eyes of the McGovern campaign. I was asked to join the national staff and worked the Democratic National Convention in Miami Beach, concentrating on the South Carolina and Arkansas delegations. Meanwhile, Hillary had gone to Washington to work for Marion Wright Edelman at the Washington Research Project, an advocacy group for children, which would soon be called the Children's Defense Fund. Her job was to investigate all-white Southern academies that were established in response to court-ordered public school integration. In the North, white parents who didn't want their kids in inner-city schools could move to the suburbs. That wasn't an option in small southern towns. The suburbs were cow pastures and soybean fields. The problem was that the Nixon administration was not enforcing the law banning such schools from claiming tax-exempt status, a move that plainly encouraged southern whites to leave public schools. I started my job for McGovern in Washington, first checking in with Lee Williams and my other friends on Senator Fulbright's staff, then going to see Congressman Wilbur Mills, the powerful chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. Mills, who was a Washington legend for his detailed knowledge of the tax code and his skill in running his committee, had announced that he would be Arkansas's favorite son candidate at the Miami convention. Such candidacies were usually launched in the hope of preventing a state's delegation from voting for the front runner, although back then, a favorite son occasionally thought lightning might strike and he would at least wind up on the ticket as the vice presidential nominee. In Mills's case, his candidacy served both purposes. The Arkansas Democrats thought McGovern, who was far ahead in the delegate count, was sure to be trounced at home in the general election, and Mills doubtless thought he would be a better president. Our meeting was cordial. I told Chairman Mills that I expected the delegates to be loyal to him, but that I would be working them to get their support on important procedural votes and on a second ballot if Senator McGovern needed one. After the Mills meeting, I flew to Columbia, South Carolina, to meet as many of the convention delegates there as possible. Many were sympathetic to McGovern, and I thought they would help us on crucial votes, despite the fact that their credentials were subject to challenge on the grounds that the delegation did not have as much racial, gender, and age diversity as the new rules written by the McGovern Commission required. Before Miami, I also went to the Arkansas Democratic Convention in Hot Springs to court my home state delegates. I knew that Governor Bumpers, who would chair the delegation in Miami, thought McGovern would hurt the Democrats in Arkansas. But as in South Carolina, a lot of the delegates were anti-war and pro-McGovern. I left for Miami feeling pretty good about both the delegations I was working. At the convention in mid-July, the major candidates had their headquarters in hotels around Miami and Miami Beach, but their operations were run out of trailers outside the convention center. The McGovern trailer was overseen by Gary Hart as national campaign manager, with Frank Mankiewicz as national political director and public spokesman, and my friend Rick Stearns as the director of research and caucus state operations. Rick knew more about the rules than anyone else. Those of us who were working the delegations were on the floor, following instructions from the trailer. The McGovern campaign had come a long way, thanks to an array of committed volunteers, Hart's leadership, Mankiewicz's handling of the press, and Stearns's strategizing. With their help, McGovern had outfought and outpolled politicians who were more established, more charismatic, or both. Hubert Humphrey, Ed Muskie, Mayor John Lindsay of New York, who had switched parties to run, Senator Henry Jackson of Washington State, and George Wallace, who was paralyzed by a would-be assassin's bullet during the campaign. Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm of New York also ran, becoming the first African-American to do so. We thought McGovern had enough votes to win on the first ballot if he could weather the challenge to the California delegation. The new McGovern rules required each state with a primary election to apportion its delegates as closely as possible to the percentage of votes they got. However, California still had a winner-take-all system and was asserting its right to keep it because the state legislature hadn't changed its election law by convention time. Ironically, McGovern favored the California system over his own rules because he had won the primary with 44% of the votes but had all of the state's 271 delegates pledged to him. The anti-McGovern forces argued that McGovern was a hypocrite and that the convention should seat only 44% or 120 delegates for him, with the other 151 being pledged to the other candidates in proportion to their share of the California primary vote. The Credentials Committee of the convention was anti-McGovern and voted to uphold the California challenge, seating only 120 of his delegates and putting his first ballot victory in doubt. The Credentials Committee's decisions could be overturned by a majority of the convention delegates. The McGovern forces wanted to do that with California. So did the South Carolina delegation, which was in danger of losing its votes because it had also been found in violation of the rules. Only 25% of the delegation were women, rather than the required half. McGovern was nominally against the South Carolina position because of that underrepresentation. What happened next was complicated and not worth going into detail about. Essentially, Rick Stearns decided that we should lose the South Carolina vote, bind our opponents to a procedural rule that benefited our challenge, then we would win the California vote. It worked. The South Carolina delegation was seated, and our opponents smelled victory. But by the time they realized they had been tricked, it was too late. We picked up all 271 delegates and clinched the nomination. The California challenge was probably the greatest example of political jiu-jitsu at a party convention since primary elections became the dominant mode of selecting delegates. As I've said, Rick Stearns was a genius on the rules. I was elated. Now McGovern was virtually guaranteed a first ballot victory, and the folks from South Carolina, whom I had come to like a lot, could stay. Alas, it was all downhill from there. McGovern entered the convention well behind, but still within striking distance of President Nixon in the opinion polls, and we expected to pick up 5 or 6 points during the week, thanks to several days of intense media coverage. Getting that kind of bounce, however, requires the kind of disciplined control of events our forces had demonstrated with the delegate challenges. For some reason, it evaporated after that. First, a gay rights group staged a sit-in at McGovern's hotel and refused to budge until he met with them. When he did, the media and the Republicans portrayed it as a cave-in that made him look both weak and too liberal. Then, on Thursday afternoon, after he picked Senator Tom Eagleton of Missouri to be his running mate, McGovern allowed other names to be put in nomination against him during the voting that night. 6 more people got in the race, complete with nominating speeches and a long roll call vote. Though Eagleton's victory was a foregone conclusion, the other 6 got some votes. So did Roger Mudd of CBS News, the television character Archie Bunker, and Mao Zedong.